So I put my talk on the notes, so you don't have to take your notes. The file will be available. If I go too quickly or too slowly, please adjust my speed. So this is a story about how to use a particular two category arising from a stack of D2 brains in order to compute link homology. So the link homology story will be on Friday, as I plan. And today I will explain the technology that we need. So to prepare, to motivate what will happen, we will consider a B-twisted 3D n equal to 4. So there is more supersymmetry than in Kevin Costello's talk. And the twist makes the 3D theory completely topological. The target will be a quiver variety, Nakajima quiver variety of the type which is depicted here. Again, this I will explain in more detail on Friday. The space-time is a disk times R. I call this R cobordism because this direction is related to link cobordisms. So the space-time has a boundary which is whose pieces are separated by boundary line defects. They are in red. So I have to explain what is the two category associated with this 3D topological theory. What is the boundary condition that we put on the boundary? It will be of NS type. In fact, all this construction can be traced to the papers by Kapustin-Witten and Gajota-Witten. Then there is also a bulk line defect going through the center. So this I will explain later. And if you take a slice, a space slice, we want to, each red line corresponds to an elementary braid. The braid is not seen in this picture. The braiding happens in extra dimensions. Again, this has to be explained. But the purpose is to compute the space of states corresponding to the spatial slice in purple. And as you go around the boundary of that slice, you see elementary braids in sequence. So the resulting space of states will be the homology of the link formed by the closure of the braid. Again, the braid is not seen here, so this is pretty formal. And the lines, the red lines correspond to cobordism. So braid time runs around the boundary. The way we compute this is by cut and paste. So we have to define a two category of a point, then to a segment connecting the inner point with the point on the boundary, we associate an object in this two category. If we connect these two half segments, we get a cut segment from boundary to boundary. And this is a category of morphisms between these two objects. If we fill in this half disk, one piece of it is the actual boundary and the other one is a cut, then we get an object in the category of morphisms, this sand segment, which is the same as the object which colors the red dot. Then there is the standard pen slice, which describes the monoidal structure of the category between two purple points. And finally, we compute the space of the spatial slice by gluing together two half disks across a common cut boundary. So we have to compute the space of humps between the left half disk and the right half disk. So this is what will happen mostly on Friday. And today I'll just describe general technology, how to define the two category, the category of morphisms, what's the monoidal structure. So I will begin with the description of the category of matrix factorizations. It's maybe a tedious story, but this is the basic technology for performing all these calculations, so please bear with me. And then when we finish the matrix factorization story, we'll talk about the two category of a symplectic variety, which is a cotangent bundle, and some variations around this. And on Friday, we'll talk about link homology and some other constructions. So first of all, let me remind you of basic algebra. A plus b squared is a squared plus b squared plus anticommutator. And if a and b anticommute, then a plus b squared is the sum of squares. This is an important relation. And there are super rules when you deal with Z-graded algebras, and Z grading is of homological nature, so it creates signs. So there is a supercommutator, which is a B minus sine adjusted BA. There is the super product rule for applying differentials to the product. And there is a super trace. If you compute a trace of an endomorphism over a Z-graded space, then it's the alternating trace over the grading subspaces, which is very familiar from Euler characteristic formula, of course. And the property is that if you compute super trace of a super commutator, it's equal to zero. So they're adjusted. Now, my goal is to motivate the notion of the category of matrix factorizations. I will try to explain that this is a rather innocent variation on the subject of a homotopy, of a standard homotopy category. Suppose A is an additive category, such as category of modules over polynomials, just the simplest example. So how do we define a homotopy category of modules? An object is a chain complex of modules. So in other words, it's a pair where M is a Z-graded module over polynomials. And D is a differential. It's an endomorphism of M as a module over A. Its degree is 1. Oh, wait a minute. Of course, of course it squares to 0. So this is a typo. It doesn't square to 1, it squares to 0. Let me correct it immediately. Sorry. Now, if you consider the space of homomorphisms from M to N, so these are linear maps which are compatible with the algebra action. And this space carries a differential, which is defined in the standard way for differentials on M and N. And you can also, to simplify your calculations, you can describe it as a commutator with the differential d tilde. If you think of F, a homomorphism from M to N, as a lower triangular homomorphism from M plus N to M plus N, which just sends M to N, then this would be a commutator with D tilde, which is block diagonal with DM and DN. So this differential here squares to zero. Why? Because it's the double commutator with d tilde, and by super Jacobi identity, it's easy to verify, is just a super commutator of the square of d tilde with f tilde. And this one squares to zero because each block squares to zero. So finally, in the homotopy category, you define the homes between chain complexes as the homology of this small differential d on all the homomorphisms between M and N as algebra homomorphisms. The condition that F is a chain map is equivalent to saying that F is closed with respect to D. And the condition that F is homotopically trivial, that's the same as F being exact with respect to D small. If you want a derived category of modules, the most pedestrian way to introduce it is to require that all the modules are free. Of course, there is much more behind this story, but as a beginning, this would work. Now, matrix factorizations. So all you need to know about them for the symplectic story. X is a variety, W is a function over X, and this matrix factorization category is the right version, I should have put quotes, of coherent sheaves over the critical locus of W. A critical locus of a polynomial function can be really, really bad, not even a complete intersection. But what you will see here is a very good, decent DG category with which you can calculate. So to simplify matters, we'll assume that X is Cn with coordinates X. So again, we work over polynomial algebra. And the object of the category of matrix factorizations is very similar to what we just had. It's a Z2 graded module, but there is a difference. First of all, the grading is Z mod 2. Some people call it a periodic complex because it's periodic mod 2. But I prefer to consider just M0 and M1. And the second difference, which is essential, is that the square of the differential is not 0, but it's W. So this is how it looks. Your module has two components, degree 0 and degree 1, and the differential shoots from left to right and from right to left, and both compositions give you multiplication by W. At this point, many people turn off because we are taught many times that the square of differential should be equal to 0. So this sits in us, so please do not turn off. You will see that this is a good category and, in fact, essential for what will happen. Now we go back to the homotopy story. We build D tilde, which is a block diagonal one, for the purpose of defining differential on the space of homomorphisms. And D tilde squared now will be W. Here is the D tilde. So each square is to W on its own module. So you will get WW. So the whole thing is identity times W. So what about D squared? The one that we need to define the homotopy category. It will be a commutator of d tilde squared with f tilde. So now d tilde squared is not 0, but it's central because it's identity matrix times W. So d small still squares to 0. So you can define a homotopy category exactly the same way as we defined the homotopy category for ordinary chain complexes. So D capital didn't have to square to 0. It had to be central. That's the lesson. And the final step is we require the module to be free, which implies that the ranks of M0 and M1 are equal. And this is the pedestrian version of the category of matrix factorizations. You have two modules of equal rank, related by these two differentials, which can now be presented just as matrices because we're dealing with free modules. And the square of this matrix is W, hence the name matrix factorization. So the name is rather technical. It does not quite reflect the deep nature of this. So an immediate example, suppose you have one variable x and your W, let's call it a superpotential, is x to the n. So here is the simplest matrix factorization you can think of. The differential going from left to right is multiplication by one power. Going from right to left by another power. If you go both ways, compose, you get x to the n. As simple as it gets. So now we go through the list of properties, which is really tedious, but again, we have to overcome this mental block. So first of all, this category is a deformation of the category of the derived category of CX modules. I should have underlined X. In a strict sense, not in a poetic sense, a deformation of a category is governed by the even part of the Hochschild cohomology, if you're familiar with this. And usually people tell you that you should take the second Hochschild cohomology because they want to keep the Z grading. So if you're ready to sacrifice Z grading, you can deform by any element, any even element in the Hochschild cohomology. And in this case, we use the zero Hochschild cohomology, which is the center. So that's why W has to be central. And in our case, the whole algebra is commutative, so any element of the algebra. Number two, look at this relation and apply the partial derivative with respect to one of the variables to both sides. The product rule, again, super product rule, tells you that on the left you get a super commutator of the differential and its partial derivative, and on the right you get a partial derivative of your superpotential. So the lesson is that the partial derivative is a commutator with the differential, so it's homologically trivial. So this gives you a hint that the category of matrix factorizations is supported in the formal neighborhood of the critical locus of W. So it sits very, very close to the critical locus, which is where...
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of
course. Yeah, so you said that D square and F commute because W is in the center, but I think it's because of the fact that F is a homomorphism of the algebra. I think W being the center is playing with the fact that your algebra itself doesn't have a differential.
Yes. So if the algebra itself.
So if the algebra has a differential, then I think the requirement is that D square is equal to the commutator with W.
Yes, yes. So this yes, thank you. This would have to be modified. So generally, it's an A infinity story about how you can deform a category. So yes, I consider a particularly simple case. And for what will happen, I do not need algebras with differential. So if
yeah,
you
thanks.
Want a general story, then any paper, look at any paper about A infinity and its deformations.
Great, thanks.
Here, thank you. The next property of matrix factorizations is the tensor product. Suppose you have two matrix factorizations and you tensor multiply them as modules and the differentials add up in the tensor product in the following way. So it's the left one tensor one plus negative one to the degree, physicists call it fermionic number, tensor D2. This one is needed so that these guys anti-commute with each other. If I put here one, they would commute, which would be wrong. What's the square of the resulting differential? Here comes the formula a plus b squared equals a squared plus b squared because they anti-commute. So as you see, the square of the differential in the tensor product is the sum of the superpotentials. So under tensor product, superpotentials add. This is a very important property. Here is a technical construction. What would be the dual of a matrix factorization? If you deal with complexes, you just take dual modules and dual homomorphisms. Here you have to put a minus sign on one of the differentials. So your dual matrix factorization will be inside the category of matrix factorizations of negative W. As a result, the home in the category of matrix factorizations between M and N is this canonically isomorphic to the homology of dual of M tensor N, as in the usual case. In case of matrix factorizations, the superpotentials add up to zero. So the square of the differential in this tensor product is zero, so you can take its homology. Next thing, Kozul matrix factorizations. A Kozul complex, for if P is a polynomial, a Kozul complex is a very convenient resolution of the factor module. It's convenient to add, to present this with the help of an extra odd variable theta. Theta is odd, which means it anti-commutes with itself. So its square equals to zero. And the differential can be presented as theta times P. So this and this would be the same. More generally, you can tensor these elementary Kozul complexes, and so this would require several thetas, and the differential will look like the sum. Or pictorially, it's a cube of these elementary complexes. If your superpotential factors as a product of two polynomials, P and Q, then you define a Kozul matrix factorization where P and Q shoot in opposite directions. And you can write this as P times theta plus Q d d theta, if you know the rules of differentiation over odd variables, which is the same as ordinary variables plus the super product rule. Now you see that the square of D is not zero because theta and d d theta anti-commute to P to one. So you will get PQ. The square of them is zero. The anti-commutator is one, will yield PQ as expected. The homological shift of a Kozul matrix factorization is very similar. You just have to switch Q and P. Generally, when you do a homological shift of matrix factorization, you simply switch M0 and M1. So in this case, it will switch P and Q. If your superpotential is a sum of products, you can define a Kozul matrix factorization, which is tensor product of elementary ones. If you deal with this Kozul matrix factorization, there are row operations, something we teach students in linear algebra course. So if you have, for example, two lines, P1, Q1, and P2, Q2, you can add a multiple of P1 to P2. R being a polynomial, and you have to subtract it backwards from Q. So you add one way, you subtract the other way. The superpotential remains the same, and this corresponds to a change of variables, to a substitution of thetas. This is a very convenient tool. For example, in the category of matrix factorizations of X to the N, you may wonder what are the endomorphisms of a Kozul matrix factorization, x to the n minus n, the elementary one. So how would you compute it quickly? Instead of computing homes, tensor with the dual. So I put here the dual one, switch them and put an extra minus. And now you do a row operation. You can do a row operation across because you can shift one of the rows, just do a translation. It's the same thing, essentially. So you subtract this way, you add one way, you subtract the other way, so you get this one, Now I need my mouse. It's still hidden, I'm sorry. So now you kill the remaining x to the n minus n. So you get a Kazul complex xn and 0, which is c of x mod x to the n. And you get the Kazul complex of 0, which is just c of theta. So this is something you would get from the ordinary complex, very similar. Another application, suppose you wonder what's the Hochschild homology or cohomology of the category of matrix factorizations. So the cohomology may be defined as endomorphisms of identity functor. In case of complexes of modules, you define the identity bimodule, the bimodule which represents identity functor, that's tensoring with C of xy mod x minus y. You tensor module over x with this, you get the same module over y. You take its resolution, you tensor it with the dual, so you get Kazul complex, kill the second row, and the answer is this one sets x equals to y, so you get only x. And this one simply gives you an extra odd variable because you have two copies of C with the shift. So the Hochschild cohomology of the polynomial algebra is the algebra on two variables, even and odd. If you do this for the category of matrix factorizations with the superpotential W of X, first of all, your bimodule, which gives you a functor, is a matrix factorization of the difference of superpotentials. If you tensor this with the matrix factorization of W of X, the superpotentials add, and you will get the matrix factorization of W of Y. If you want identity, you take this diagonal bimodule and supplement it with the differential shooting backwards. And there is one obvious choice coming from Bézout theorem. X equals y, so the difference of polynomials is divisible by x minus y. Let's call it W of x and y. If you want Hochschild cohomology, you take the endomorphisms of this matrix factorization. Again, with the help of rows. Again, you cross kill. Again, this one sets x equal to y. But now the second row, which was row of zeros in the ordinary case, now has w prime. When you set x equal to y in the divided difference, you get the derivative. So you have a Kazul complex which kills the derivative of w. So the Hochschild cohomology is c of x mod the derivative. It's called Jacobi algebra, I think. Here is a nice fact. If you have a sequence of polynomials which form a regular sequence, which means p sub I is not a zero divisor in the quotient by the previous ones, then in the Kazul matrix factorization, only the left column matters. So if you can present W, the same W, as this sum or this sum, just change the choice of Qs. You will get the isomorphic matrix factorization. You do not even need homotopy here. It will be equivalent by row isomorphic by row operations. Okay, now something a little bit more advanced. If you talk to derived algebraic geometry people, you will quickly see derived schemes. DG, should have said DG schemes. Algebras with differentials, as I have this question. Matrix factorizations give you a way to avoid it. in certain cases. Or you can trade them off. So let's recall the
Just a question on what came above. For Hochschild cohomology, why don't you get the derived critical locus of W rather than the
ordinary one? If you have one variable and assume the W prime is not equal to zero.
Fine.
But generally, thank you for the comment. If you have more than one variable here, then you will get a multi-row Kozul matrix factorization with all the partial derivatives of W. And if the partial derivatives of W do not form a regular sequence, then your answer will be different from the Jacobi algebra. So you will get a sort of derived Jacobi algebra, the Kozul complex itself as an algebra.
Thanks.
So this is a standard Kozul duality between the modules over the polynomial algebra. I should have said graded, but let me sweep this under the rug. It's equivalent to the derived category of modules over an odd variable. The equivalence is established by tensoring one way or the other with a differential module, which is C of A and theta, and the differential being A times theta. So if you're not familiar with this, I suggest that you check that at home, how this works. A rank one free module becomes a simple module, and vice versa. If you work with, now suppose that you sub, actually before we go there, suppose that I deform this by superpotential A to the n. You see, since these are equivalent, not only they're equivalent as categories, but the whole family of their deformations is equivalent. So what if I introduce A to the n as a superpotential on this side? A to the n is an element of the Hochschild cohomology, which, if you recall, is C of A and theta. So from the A point of view, I introduce the zero of cohomology and get matrix factorizations. From the theta point of view, the variable A carries homological degree 2. So from the A point of view, a superpotential on this side is a, how do you call it, multi-multiplication, A infinity thing. An n multiplication for thetas. So on this side, you will get an A infinity type deformation of the category of modules over C of theta, which tells you that sometimes matrix factorizations are nicer. It's enough to know the point of the story is that high school algebra is more or less enough to deal with them. Okay, but here we consider a simpler case. We add extra variables x and consider a superpotential which is linear in A. The Kozul duality tells us that on the other side, you get the modules over theta and extra variables, of course, but with a differential. So you kill the... See, here, if you take the derivative with respect to A, you get your F. So you know that F is homologically trivial on the left side. On the right side, you kill it by the differential in the algebra. You get DG algebra with a reasonable differential. So in other words, this is a DG scheme where you take the quotient by F. If F is non-zero, you can drop the differential and simply consider the modules over the factor algebra. But if you have more than one A and more than one F, and Fs do not form a regular sequence, then on the right you have to keep your differential. You cannot get rid of them. So you get a genuine DG scheme. And on the right you still have a simple superpotential to play with. The equivalence, by the way, is established by the matrix factorization by module, which carries A times theta, which you had previously, plus this piece, which from the A point of view tells you that the square of D is AF. And from the theta point of view, this one is required to for consistency with the differential of the algebra. So this is the bimodule which does it. Okay, we're close to the end of this. Few more properties of matrix factorizations. There is a famous Knorr periodicity, which says that if you supplement your variables x by two variables, let's call them a and b, and add their product to the superpotential, then this is equivalent to just x. You can drop two variables if they're related bilinearly. The equivalence goes in the obvious way. If you have matrix factorization on the right, tensor it with the Kozul matrix factorization of A times B. And this is an equivalence of categories. You can generalize this a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit. Suppose that your W, the superpotential, has a smooth critical locus, which may happen sometimes. And moreover, the matrix of partial derivatives in the normal, in the transverse direction to the critical locus is non-degenerate. So this is a generalization of this situation. In this case, with respect to A and B, at least, in this case, the category of matrix factorizations, star means it's not exactly true. You should consult a paper by Konstantin Telemann who considered this in detail. It's not exactly true, but very close to being true that these two categories are equivalent. So if your critical locus is good, being smooth and transverse and quadratic in a transverse direction, then this and this is the same, except you have to allow differentials shooting both ways in your complex. It's still two periodic. But the square is equal to zero. So it's almost the same as coherent sheaves over the critical locus. The category of matrix factorizations is triangulated, as you may expect. So if you have two matrix factorizations related by a chain map like this, then add them together, add F to the differential, the whole thing will square to W again. If you go into technical papers that we write on link homology, especially the old one with Misha Kovanov, you will see that the following exact triangle is particularly important. So it's good to know that it's there. In the case of ordinary modules, derived category of modules, consider three modules for two polynomials, the quotient by P, the quotient by Q, and the quotient by PQ. So this may be considered as a submodule, and this may be considered as a factor module. This is an exact sequence which gives you an exact triangle. In the realm of matrix factorizations, this story is more symmetric. All three are on equal footing. Suppose you have three polynomials, and your W is a product of three polynomials. There are three ways to split this triple product into one versus two and create Kozul matrix factorizations. And all these three matrix factorizations form an exact triangle. So when you see when your superpotential factors into three, there should be an interesting exact triangle related to it. That's the lesson. And here I wrote it explicitly, how it works, all the maps. So you can check if you wish. Finally, in relation to what Justin Hilburn said in the morning, Suppose you really want to have a Z grading, not Z mod 2 grading in your category. There is a way to restore it, but you have to pay a price. So your variety should have an action of C star. I call it C star sub T. And require that the degree of the superpotential with respect to this action, or the weight, is equal to 2. And then for a matrix factorization, you require that the module has the compatible action of C star, and the degree of the differential with respect to T is equal to 1. So then the weights with respect to C star will be the homological Z grading. So you can have your Z grading, but it will, but some coordinates in X will carry even homological degrees. That's the lesson. Okay, that's all about matrix factorizations. Do you have any questions? Again, don't be, the problem with matrix factorizations is that people want the square of their differentials to be equal to 0. Definitely. And it's hard to persuade them to. Okay, now the symplectic story. Let me move it a little bit. So, an important construction for an algebraic variety is the derived category of coherent sheaves. It's a very popular construction, which has interesting properties. So, what if your algebraic variety is symplectic? Let's assume it's smooth. What do I mean by symplectic variety? In fact, I'll mean two things. Either it's a smooth variety which has a holomorphic symplectic 2 form, so same as real but holomorphic, 2-0. Or it's a smooth variety which has a Hamiltonian action of an algebraic group, and we take a Hamiltonian reduction. If we take a holomorphic Hamiltonian reduction, you may get something similar, something singular in principle, but for me it would still be a valid symplectic variety. So to this, it seems that one can associate a 2 category, which is the 2 category of boundary conditions of a 3DB model, which Justin discussed in the morning. We considered it in two papers, one with Anton and Natalia, and we had another one more mathematical in detail with Anton. We do not have a full rigorous definition for the general symplectic manifold, but I'll show you that we have a good definition for the contingent bundle, for the case when this is a contingent bundle. And we have a detailed we also can tell what happens if you cut a piece out of the contingent bundle. And we have a detailed, in the second paper, we have a detailed discussion of what happens or may happen when you deform the contingent bundle as a symplectic variety. But this is not related to the story, so I'll skip it. First, the naive definition of this 2 category. An object consists of 2 pieces. So guys, it's similar to the Foucault-Fleurier story, except that this is a 2 category and everything is holomorphic. You take a Lagrangian subvariety in your symplectic variety, and you take some sort of vibration or singular vibration map from L to L. This thing sits separately, not related to this one in any way. Just only the target is a Lagrangian subvariety. The category of morphisms, naively, is the following. You restrict your vibrations, or whatever this is, to the intersection of the Lagrangian bases, and multiply the fibers, and take coherent sheaves. So of course, this is naive, but this is true, again with a star, in case when your subvarieties are smooth and have a good intersection. What do I mean by good? The intersection looks locally like an intersection of their tangent spaces. So for example, they do not have to be transverse. They may, for example, coincide, and that would be just fine. That would be considered as a good intersection. What we do not want is, in say, in XY, in T star of C, you may have y equal to 0, the 0 section of T star. And let's say y equals to x squared, parabola. And they touch at 0, and that's not good. That's a bad intersection for us. And moreover, in in many interesting cases, the basis of these vibrations are singular inside the symplectic variety. And the vibration, and this thing is not a bundle, the fiber jumps. In fact, in some cases, this is a resolution of L. So various things may happen. So what would be a rigorous definition of this category in the case when this is a cotangent bundle? The simplest, I say simple in quotes because I use it metaphorically. It's not a mathematical term here. Not like simple module. A simple object is just a function over the variety X, and the category of morphisms is the category of matrix factorizations. The composition of morphisms is the tensor product, because as we observed, under the tensor product, the superpotentials add. So when you add the differences, you get the superpotential which you need, that you need for the home between 1 and 3. So it's really good that they add. Why does this make sense from the symplectic point of view? That's because W determines a Lagrangian subvariety in the cotangent bundle, which is the graph of the differential. Justin mentioned that. The simplest example is when your x is C, the cotangent bundle is C2 with coordinates x and y, and your Lagrangian subvariety is y equals the derivative of W. If you consider the projection of the cotangent bundle to the base, this projection establishes a bijection between the intersection of two such Lagrangian subvarieties and the critical locus of W2 minus W1. The proof is obvious. Let me do it for this case. When do these graphs intersect? When the derivative of W1 equals the derivative of W2, that's when y's would match. So the good intersection between these Lagrangians means that the category of coherent sheaves, sorry, that the category of matrix factorizations that we assign for their home reduces to coherent sheaves over the critical locus. So the goodness of intersection is the goodness of the critical locus. Sorry, where am I here? So this definition with matrix factorizations matches the naive expectation, but it also covers bad intersections. And that's the good thing. For example, if W is equal to 0, you get the 0 section as your Lagrangian subvariety, and the morphism is matrix factorizations of 0, which is coherent sheaves to periodic on the nose. And by the way, coherent sheaves on X is a monoidal category, the monoidal structure being given by tensor product. So you may ask, why do coherent sheaves have this extra structure of tensor product? And the answer is because this is the endomorphism of X as zero section of the two category of the Cartesian bundle. So there is a purpose for this monoidal structure, conceptually speaking.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
So these are like boundary conditions, and I think your endomorphism the category of lines on a boundary?
I'm sorry, say it again, please.
So are these, I understand these are boundary conditions of your
yes, in the
theory.
Yes.
And so these endomorphism categories, the category lines on the boundary?
Yes, so if your line separates the same boundary condition on the left and on the right, which is a Lagrangian subvariety, then on the line you put a coherent sheaf over that Lagrangian subvariety, and when two lines compose, then you get tensor product of those sheaves.
Could you explain why then this, like the coherent sheaf is also symmetric, which means that it doesn't matter which way you fuse them.
Ah, yes. Thank you.
Whereas boundary lines don't seem to be. Yeah, thanks.
Yes.
That's the question.
Yes. So this is a fragile property. The fact that this monoidal structure is commutative is kind of fragile, and there is a way to categorically quantize. There is an interesting story which we didn't quite explore in our paper. So we made some first steps. There is a way to quantize this, which is similar to the old story of Kontsevich quantization of algebras. And so in this case, you make the tensor product non-commutative by deforming this monoidal category. So the sheaves remain, but the tensor product can be deformed with something that students used to learn in geometry under the name the second fundamental form. So the second fundamental form shows up in this algebraic geometry story, and if it represents a non-trivial class, it allows you to deform the tensor product, make it non-commutative. So this is not quite related to the link homology story, so maybe if people are interested, I'll be happy to comment on this.
Let me ask a follow-up on that. So you're saying, first, if we take the boundary condition that's just the zero section, then its endomorphism category is in fact symmetric by accident.
Yes.
But there should be a way to deform
this
boundary condition that...
In fact, you'll have to deform the whole two category.
Oh, I see.
So
it's not just this object.
So you see, this is a special... Let me make another comment. In real symplectic geometry, there is a theorem by Darboux, which says that a neighborhood of a Lagrangian submanifold is isomorphic to its Cartesian bundle. So everything looks, first of all, locally like a Cartesian bundle, but in real case also globally, the neighborhood of a Lagrangian, I'll be looking at you, and if I say something wrong, please, I'm really not an expert. Symplectic algebraic geometry, this is no longer true. In fact, in algebraic geometry, even a neighborhood of a subvariety doesn't have to look like a normal bundle. So in particular, a neighborhood of a Lagrangian subvariety doesn't have to look globally like a Cartesian bundle. Another way of saying it is that you may start with a Cartesian bundle and then deform it as a symplectic variety. So it will no longer be a Cartesian bundle as a symplectic variety. You deform both complex structure and symplectic structure. There are ways to do it. And if you do this, then the zero section is still Lagrangian, but its endomorphisms become non-commutative. And the first deformation comes from this second fundamental form, and the second deformation comes from the curvature. So there is a separate story. Maybe I'll comment on that later,
There's some deformation of the 3D theory that accomplishes this. Thanks.
So again, this commutativity is due to the fact that the symplectic variety is a Cartesian bundle, and that's why we have this phenomenon of commutativity. But it didn't have to be that way. A general object of this two category is a pair where Z is an auxiliary variety, just anything, and W is a function on X and Z. The category of morphisms between two such pairs is matrix factorizations on X and the product of auxiliary varieties of the difference of superpotentials. From the symplectic geometry point of view, this corresponds to the following. Consider the product of Cartesian bundles of X and Z. And there, consider the graph of dW, which sits here same way. But now W depends on both X and Z. Intersected with the zero section of Z. So I impose a condition that the Cartesian coordinates to Z are equal to zero. If you project it down to X, this will project generally to a Lagrangian subvariety in X. So if you were subjected to the subject that in Russia was called analytic mechanics, and you had to study the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, then these pieces would be familiar. So in Arnold's book on classical mechanics, this is explained, these tricks. So for example, suppose that we still work with T star of C, so the coordinate is X, and we introduce an auxiliary coordinate A, and a superpotential of A and W will determine this L thing as points in CA cross T star CX with two equations, Y is dW dx, and the condition that A derivative of W is zero. So the most important example is consider W, which is A times X, and this will tell you that Y has to be equal to A, that's the first equation, and the second equation is that X has to be equal to zero. In fact, you have there is no fibration because the value of A is fixed by Y. So all you get is arbitrary Y and X equal to zero. So this way you describe a Lagrangian subvariety, which is a fiber at zero. It does not have a nice projection onto the base, but you can still describe it in this manner by using auxiliary variables. Now, in relation to what Justin was explaining in the morning, there is a standard trick in additive categories. Suppose you pick an object in your additive category, and you can turn any other object, into a module over the endomorphisms of A. So the endomorphisms of A form an algebra in additive category, because you can compose. And any object B turns into homes from A to B, which you can now compose with endomorphisms of A. And this gives you a module structure. Let's do the same trick on the two category, as an object will pick the zero section. The endomorphisms are coherent sheaves with tensor product. And any object B turns into a module category over coherent sheaves with tensor product. Sounds scary. Presumably, this is an equivalence of categories. I put here red star because I'm not sure about the status of this claim, but people here, I'm sure, can give you much more information. I'll just give you an example how this works. Again, we consider a contingent bundle to C. And let's take this object, which is a y-axis, a fiber at zero, which we describe with the help of A. X equals to zero, in other words. The endomorphisms of this object, what are the endomorphisms of this object according to our rules? It's the matrix factorization of X, auxiliary variable from the first copy of the object, and B, which is auxiliary variable from the second copy. Recall that we need fiber of the first object and fiber of the second. That's why the variable A doubled. And we take the difference between the superpotentials. Now we recall that by Knorr periodicity, we can remove X and one of the variables, let's say B. So we'll be left with matrix factorizations of one variable and zero superpotential. So up to two periodicity, we get modules over the polynomial algebra of A, which matches our expectation, of course, because that's the home between Lagrangian subvariety and itself, so it's the sheaves over it. Now, the homes between this object and W equal to zero, that would be matrix factorizations of AX. By Knorr, this is just vectors, the category of vector spaces. So what would be its endomorphisms? How do we get this? The answer, because the endomorphisms of the vector spaces is vector spaces. The endofunctors. You just tensor with vector spaces. That's all that can happen there. How do we get polynomials? The answer is that this is not just a category. It's a module over this category. So wise people will tell you that you need a resolution, similar to how you use resolution in coherent sheaves. The y-axis, looks like a skyscraper from the point of view of the x-axis. So you take the skyscraper and replace it with a resolution. This is a Kazul resolution, which you now interpret not as a module, but as an algebra. Therefore, I write the differential with as a derivative. So this is an algebra, and I'm supposed to consider modules over the tensor product of this algebra with itself. In the second copy, I drop the differential and take the quotient by x. So the home means take the product of this algebra with itself over C of x. And the result will be the modulus over C of theta. So in ordinary algebraic geometry, the tor between skyscraper and itself is C of theta. Here we get the same thing, but now this C of theta is the algebra, and we have to consider modulus over this algebra. And by Kazul duality, this is the same as our symplectic answer. So Kazul duality, even versus Wood, establishes equivalence between symplectic and derived algebraic descriptions of the cotangent bundle. So now you may wonder, why did we even build this symplectic story with matrix factorization if we could discuss it from the derived algebraic geometry perspective? And you will see the answer. So there are some things that you can easily do on the symplectic side, and which may look, I don't know how to do them on the derived side. We'll get there. Finally, what would be an equivariant version of the two category? Suppose that you have an algebraic group acting on X, and we want a two category of the Hamiltonian reduction of the cotangent bundle. And we will replace it with the equivariant two category of the cotangent bundle. So we will not go into the delicate definition here, we'll just work with this. But if we have to, we will impose the stability condition. So I'll comment on that on Friday. So an object in this, two category is again a pair, but now the group must act on Z. And W should be invariant with respect to G. And the category of morphisms will be G-equivariant matrix factorizations between G-equivariant matrix factorizations of what you would expect from the old definition. Sorry?
Why do you have to take a tangent of X? X was already symplectic, right?
No. It's the category of, no, X is not symplectic.
Okay.
So when, for a symplectic, I put letters SM to distinguish them. So with the help of, this definition, we can define two categories of corresponding to Nakajima quiver varieties. The only missing thing is how to impose stability, and that I didn't prepare the notes, so I'm afraid I will get lost. So I'd rather say it on Friday or during the answer session. I just have to think for a few minutes. But so let me just say it as a statement. When you do quotients, often, instead of taking the whole cotangent bundle, you subtract certain closed subvariety from it. The matrix factorization definition is easily adapted to cutting a piece from the cotangent bundle. We'll just cut a piece from this. I think maybe I can even tell you what should be cut. This thing can be sent to T star X in two ways. You take X, for example, X cross Z, and you use W1. You can send this to T star X by taking derivative of the graph of the differential of W1 with respect to x. And so you take the preimage of your stable subspace that you want there. Maybe I can write this down. I apologize, I forgot to write this. So consider, for example, x cross z, be it z1 or z2. You can send it to t star x with the help of the differential of w. And w, I remind you, is a function on x cross z. You take the differential along x. This gives you the fiber coordinate. And that's all you need. So if here you have a subspace, then you take the preimage of this map, and you replace x cross z1 and x cross z2 with these preimages and take their intersection. In other words, it's a very straightforward way to cut a piece from this to make it stable. In fact, again, I'll comment maybe on Friday on this, you can stabilize only one pair. The stability of the second pair will follow because of the criticality condition, because the category resides on the critical locus. And on the critical locus, imposing stability on x with z1 is the same as imposing stability on x with z2. So they coincide. So it's sufficient to impose one. There are some technical advantages to this. And so you can, now you can define two categories associated to Nakajima quiver varieties and play this game. So just one, as advertisement for Friday, what will happen on Friday is, first of all, we will consider this quiver, which is cotangent bundle to the algebra GLN with Hamiltonian reduction by GLN. The X in this case is the algebra GLN itself with the adjoint action. So now we'll bring a strangely looking object. We will bring a cotangent bundle to the flag variety. There is a well-known map. It's the moment map, which maps it to the nilpotent cone inside GLN. So we will use an object T star FLN with the superpotential, which is the trace of mu times X, where X is the matrix of this GLN. So this will be our object, let's call it A. The endomorphisms, the category of endomorphisms of this object, I will, with the help of simple properties of matrix factorizations, I'll show you that this is the same as the category of GLN equivariant coherent sheaves on what's known as derived Steinberg variety. and Bezrukhovnikov and Risch. Constructed the homomorphism from a fine braid group into this category. And this is the beginning of our work with Alexey Oblomkov. Towards the link homology. So this is the first thing we'll do on Friday. As you see, there are many strange things that happen here. The auxiliary variety happens to be symplectic, and the superpotential has a very special form. So this is not a coincidence, in fact, because this comes from a three category appearing in Kapustin-Witten construction, which is in fact even a four category. So I'll try to venture a little bit in that story. I should finish here.
All right, thank you, Lev. Are there any questions from the audience? Peter?
Should I think of this boundary condition you're writing down at the very end as?
I'm sorry.
Should I think of this boundary condition as a dimensional reduction of the study by Gyuto-Witten in 40 n equals 4?
Okay, so let me again. It's a spoiler for Friday. The reason for this strange object to emerge is that the boundary of that solid cylinder that I showed in the beginning looks like this. Let me make it even bigger. So this is, so here we have this. Here we have, say, this. Here we have this. So if you smash, and these are NS5 brains, and between those brains live commuting varieties. So if you smash this together, it will create T star FL3 with the superpotential that I mentioned. Each individual NS5 represents a Lagrangian correspondence between two commuting varieties, and in fact, it looks like an edge of another. So this is an edge of another Nakajima quiver. This is a story of two quivers. It's Kapustin-Witten with two arrangements of interfaces. One arrangement giving you, in this case, commuting variety, or an instanton moduli space if you generalize it, and the other arrangement is compressed to create the boundary of the solid cylinder. So to see that this is really a quiver edge. Now this picture was drawn in this form. Was drawn either by Tudor or by Justin. And when I first saw it, somehow I didn't like the aesthetics, but now I fully adopt. So if here you have N1, and here you have N2, then the correspondence is given by auxiliary variables let's call them phi 1, 2, and phi 2, 1, which are homes from CN1 to CN2 and backwards. And the superpotential will be trace of x1. Guys, if I confuse the order of phi's, please forgive me. The critical locus will describe a well-known Lagrangian correspondence between these two Nakajima varieties. So good news is that this arrangement can be generalized to many other Nakajima quivers, which allows us to have a suitable description for Lagrangian correspondences between Nakajima quivers, which means that we can bring the two-category technology to build various constructions around it. And this is very smooth, even for non-smooth. So the advantage of matrix factorizations is that everything is smooth, at least in poetic, in metaphoric sense. So I think this answers. We can also have a D5. At least for commuting varieties, we can also describe a D5, which is a, again, I'm advertising what will happen on Friday.
So, I mean, I would have thought this result by Bezrukovnikov and Riesch was sort of about an action on the coherent sheaves on T star flag without this superpotential.
Yes. So let me comment on this a little bit. So in there, so first of all, the story, as I was explained, is maybe. I was told that Bezrukovnikov came up with the idea that the action should be there, and he wrote about it, and then he asked Riesch to write explicit formulas for the action. If you look in their papers, you will see, in fact, two things, two constructions. So there is the basic construction is from a fine braid to coherent sheaves over derived Steinberg. And from there, you can transform this or modify this into functors from equivariant coherent sheaves on cotangent bundle to flags to itself.
Yeah.
So this is kind of secondary construction. The mother construction is coherent sheaves over equivariant derived Steinberg and no matrix factorizations. But there is the word derived. Mm-hmm. And as I said, derived can be translated into matrix factorization with linear superpotential. And this superpotential over here, this one, is indeed linear in X. So if you use this linearity, then it will translate into derived Steinberg. So the derived comes free if you adapt this approach. You see on the nose, and in addition, for example, the Legendre transform, which flips base and fiber in T-star CN, will turn the derived Steinberg into derived Grothendieck Steinberg, where the fiber is all matrices instead of nilpotent ones, which respect the flag. And moreover, if I get to this on Friday, this flip corresponds to there is some GLN lurking in the background. It's related to GLN being presented as GLN0 versus GLN0N. Which means that the same fundamental representation can appear at the categorification level in two guises, as an even one or as an odd one. So there is a story. This technology, which manifests the symplectic structure of the commuting variety, which is hidden in the story of Bezrukavnikov and Risch. There is no commuting variety. It just, you have a glimpse. You have the Kozul dual of this X in there. When they say derived, they mean Kozul dual of the X matrix. Mm-hmm. So if you bring it into symplectic form and then start doing Legendre, you see that you can combine even and odd versions of GLN representation. So, but this is for Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is maybe getting slightly technical and I should just ask you afterwards, but you know, this affine braid group action, this is a special case of a general construction that works for any symplectic resolution. Like this is the wall crossing functors. Wall crossing functors. As parallel transport, as you like, you think about the was it FI or mass parameter? I guess FI. The FI parameter. You think about doing a path in the FI parameters of your 3D theory, and that becomes that varies the Kähler parameters.
Yes.
Of the underlying variety. And somehow there's some functor on coherent sheet. I mean, this is this, you know, sort of story from Andre and Roman's work. And so it just sort of, I don't know, one of the things that has always been a bit mysterious to me is like, why is the category of coherent sheaves, which is something about a like 2D sigma model into that guy, showing up in this 3D story? And your answer is something like, ah, that's the wrong thing to think about. But, you know, I'm not sure that's quite true. Yeah.
This is a two-dimensional story. All of the wall crossing is happening on a boundary of a 3D story, which mm-hmm. is two-dimensional. That's right. Yeah.
The composition of matrix factorizations you had earlier, is it precisely this collision of boundary with an interface?
Oh, no. Sorry.
So
no,
then what is the composition?
This is one floor above. This is the composition of Lagrangian correspondences.
Okay.
So it's not the tensor product of matrix factorizations. It's something else. Again, I'll write it on Friday, but it's a rather, again, straightforward way. If your Lagrangian correspondence is described in terms of action, same as Lagrangian subvariety, then there is a simple prescription how to compose them.
Okay, so but then can you say what is the composition of matrix factorizations you had earlier?
Where is it in this story?
You had a prescription where you add superpotentials. So what does it correspond to?
It corresponds, so X is a common factor. X is the base coordinate. So you will be having, so the category for where you send affine braids in this story will be the category of matrix factorizations, which is GLN. And so it will have the base GLN, that's where X lives, and it will have two copies of the flag. It looks a little bit scary because these are auxiliary, so you have two copies of them. And the superpotential will be the difference. It will be trace X of mu 2 minus mu 1. So when you compose, you will go through three flags and then do push forward over the intermediate flag, but your superpotentials will add up. So x mu 2 will cancel. You will get x mu 3 minus x mu 1.
So matrix factorization, they correspond to boundary conditions, right?
No. No. Matrix factorization is a line on the boundary.
Ah.
So,
okay.
So here is the slice picture. This is the slice. So here you have flags sitting on the boundary, T star flag, and another T star flag sitting on the boundary.
No, if it's a line, then okay.
And this is where the matrix factorization resides. It's a line defect.
Sorry for interrupting. In the first part of your talk, was it also a line or a boundary?
It's always a line.
Always
in
a
this
line.
In the story, it's always a line.
There's a collision of lines when you
on the so matrix factorization is a line on the boundary, and Lagrangian subvariety and whatever hangs over it is a boundary condition, is a piece of the boundary, and matrix factorization separate them.
And superpotentials add up when you collide lines.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So when you collide lines, the superpotentials add up.
Thanks.
Any other questions from the Zoom audience?
Can I ask a question? So for you were explaining how you can use the endomorphism of an object and say that any other object can be represented as a module of this guy. And so the lines on the boundary have more structure than just being a module of this algebra. It also has an action of line operators from the bulk, which, and then when you say that you can forget about this action from the bulk and just look at this as a module of boundary line operator. Could you explain why that's true?
So just to recapitulate what you said, so here we have a boundary, and let's say we have the same boundary condition everywhere here. So we have various endomorphisms which will form an algebra because when you collide them, I'm just repeating what you say, and then each object B, each boundary condition B turns into whatever you can put on that line. And so, again, the philosophy of selecting an object and turning everybody into modules over its endomorphisms corresponds to this. But then there are also lines which live in the bulk. But this is a separate story about the Drinfeld center of this category. Of this two category, which would be coherent sheaves on T star X, but with a funny braided monoidal structure, so you can bring it to the boundary. That would be the Harishchandra functor. But I'm not sure that this is a good way of describing boundary conditions. So many people study the line operators in the bulk, but I do not know whether this can be. So in other words, you want to reconstruct the two category from its center. I'm not sure that this is the right approach.
So sorry, I was asking something more basic. I was just asking, you can view B as hum AB, which is a module of N A. Then the hum between them is just functors that preserve this module structure of N A.
Yes.
But if I look at these as boundary line operators, then hum between them should be like functors that also preserve the action of the bulk lines. So can I ask you why it's automatic that any functor automatically does that?
So this is a complicated story. A bulk line turns into it's a center. So there are two ways, I guess, to describe what a center or derived center is. You can say that this is the endomorphism, the category of endomorphisms of identity functor, or it equips every object with a special endomorphism which is central in a certain sense. So when you move, so when you move this solid green dot to an open green dot on the boundary, you create an endomorphism of A, or you could turn it into endomorphism of B. And the picture suggests that the that this green open green dot is commutative, because you can move it this way or you can move it that way. It's the same thing. So it doesn't matter where you place it. So it commutes with the homes between A and B.
I see. So basically what we are trying to say is, if I view these as algebras, then algebras in the bulk is already Hausdorff homology to you, which of course commute with everything. Yeah.
Cool. Yes.
Yeah, thanks. Can I ask you another question, which is how do you see the relation between like this two category for an ungauged theory versus a gauged theory? Is there like functors between them?
I'm sorry, say it again, please.
So how do you view the relation between the gauged category and an ungauged two category? Are there functors between them?
I think you decide from the outset whether you wanted what it is, whether it's gauged or ungauged. I do not quite see how you might relate them. So you may have different gauge groups separated by interface, but it's a somewhat, and that's what we will, in a sense, this is what we'll consider on Friday. So this picture of an interface between two commuting varieties indeed represents separating two different gauge groups, GLN1 and GLN2, together with matter.
Thank you.
All right, let's thank Lev one last time.